is side two of tape 398, July 20th, 1979. I want to speak a little bit about Charles Bates in San Francisco in regards to the George Moscone and Harvey Milk murders and the Robert Opel murders and the counterintelligence activities that are going on in that city that I keep referring to, the SLA, the Zebra killings, the Zodiac killings. Charles Bates, who was head of the FBI in San Francisco through all this counterintelligence, he moved out to California after the Watergate, announced this last week that he would run for the chief of police job of Charles Gaines. Charles Bates has been sitting with a corporation, I'm sure it's a large fund for all kinds of terrorism and counterintelligence. It's Burns International Security Services. It advises corporations on plant security and protection of their top executives. That's like DISC, Defense Industry Security Command, to protect the people making ammunitions and weapons and space contracts, the clearances for them to work on these projects. There's also an International Security Services, and when Charles Bates left the FBI in San Francisco, he stayed on the West Coast in Oakland and San Francisco to head this organization of this International Security Services as part of the security on plants and employment of executives in these fascist countries whose lives are always in danger because of the people kidnapping them or killing them or overthrowing the government. The street scenes and the riots become very clear, and I knew there was something suspicious about those riots at the time of the sentencing of Dan White. At that time, the counterintelligence had to be working in the gay community. Mom O'Shea from KPFA, who's been an activist in the political scene in the northern area, told me about her being knocked down and injured by people rioting down at Castro Street, and they weren't from the area, and they weren't gays, and when she recorded interviews, they smashed her tape cassette and took the tapes out. The police cars that were lined in front of the city hall the night of the riots were just like toy soldiers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just lined in a row. And the cameras very nicely photographed each police car catching fire. Well, the police are not that kind to the gay community in San Francisco that they would let all these windows be broken and this violence proceed. They would have gone on and smashed their heads like they did the anti-war movement. But one by one, these cars were shown just in flames like little toy cars, and Gaines was accused of being too weak. But what happened was that the gay community became charged for being violent and destructive, and the intent was to let this thing come down. People came into the area with new boots and new sticks, and they were knocking people down, and the violence and the burning was taking place. There have been no charges yet about people who burned the cars. There was going to be a complete investigation. That's been totally hushed up. And at the time, I thought that Chief of Police Gaines would get a slap on the hand for the delay, because the delay is what was supposed to take place. Now, Gaines has been told to resign or be fired by the first of the year by Mayor Dianne Feinstein, but he's already been suggested as maybe running for the mayor. That was in the paper yesterday. And there's political appointments everywhere available to Gaines. But Charlie Bates is an important person. If you don't have my article, the SLA is the CIA. You can get them from research in Aptos. I don't have any more copies. And there's much about Charles Bates and the counterintelligence activities that he's been doing. And in January 23, 1972, on those White House tapes at the height of Watergate, Richard Nixon gave an order to limit the FBI investigation into the break-in, and he said he wanted no more concern than a small-town mayor might show for a parking ticket fixed for a friend. Nixon said, don't lie to them to the extent that there's no involvement. Just say it's a comedy of errors and that we wish for the country that it doesn't go, we don't go any further in the case. In James McCord's book, A Piece of Tape, he also tells how John Dean met in Patrick Gray's office. Gray was the appointing, he was the acting head of the FBI, appointed May 3rd, 72, just weeks before the Watergate arrest, 6 weeks before. And John Dean had gone to Patrick Gray to suppress the story of the Watergate arrest. And then, as I say, McCord's book, He says that Dean first met in Gray's office regarding the FBI Watergate investigation, and Gray informed him that Charles Bates of the FBI was handling the investigation. See, Charles Bates was setting up the counterintelligence, known as the SLA later, but he was handling the investigation of Watergate, and then when that was safely put into other hands, he moved out to the West Coast, where by 1974, the full counterintelligence against the American Indian Movement, the United Prisoners Union, the United Farm Workers Movement, the lesbians on the West Coast, the anti-war demonstrators, the Venceremos, the Chicanos, they were all being infiltrated and the leaders were being killed, such as Popeye Jackson from the United Prisoners Union and agents. Sary Jane Moore worked for the FBI and was an agent working in Randolph Hearst's office. This can of worms goes right back to the office of Charles Bates. And in my SLA article that was published in 1974, the SLA is a CIA, I describe the similarities to the burning of the people at the SLA in Los Angeles to the killing in Chicago of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. Now, Charles Bates was in the FBI in Chicago in 1969 at the FBI offices. He moved in 71 to the General Investigative Division of the FBI in Washington, D.C., and then came out to head the FBI in California. But the parallels between the killing of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were so clear, just as the parallels between the burning of the SLA with the CBS cameras, the dinner cameras watching it, and the cameras watching the gay demonstrations in San Francisco, orchestrated by counterintelligence. In each of these cases, like the Hampton-Clark case, before they were murdered, they were drugged by a man who worked for the FBI, and Donald DeFries and Christine Johnson and people inside of the house in Los Angeles were also drugged before the burning began. The police involved in Chicago with Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and the police involved in Los Angeles with the burning and shooting were both told that in each case these people had killed a policeman earlier and there was this vengeance that worked them up, and later they were found out they had been deliberately misinformed. Fred Hampton and Mark Clark had not killed Chicago policemen, and Donald DeFries in the SLA had not killed policemen in Los Angeles. The article, The SLA is the CIA, goes into the Nazi Minutemen FBI connections of California intelligence. I think it's a very important article for those of you that haven't read that. That was my third published article in The Realist. And Charles Bates, the man who was to work with Patrick Gray and the FBI cover-up of the Watergate story until it really began to unfold, now is being suggested to run for chief of police in San Francisco, which is outrageous. Of course, the man behind Dianne Feinstein, who's right in the middle working with these people, is a man named Richard Bloom. There's a long article about him in the San Francisco Chronicle this last year called Dianne's Right-Hand Man. He works for the URS Corporation, are the initials. He acquired the Evelyn Wooding Reading Dynamics for $7 million, and he sells advanced training to Fortune Magazine's top 100 companies on international business, architecture, planning, and design. And he works for the company for the acquisition of new companies, collecting together and putting them into one piece of a pie. He merges companies. This Bloom is director of a mutual fund, a real estate company in Australia, and served until just this last December every month advising the White House on how to revitalize the nation's cities. Well, you see what's happening in San Francisco, the way that city is being revitalized. If the former FBI man runs for the chief of police and the chief of police wants to be the mayor, we're really in trouble, and I know we are anyway, but the Opal case and the way he was murdered, and I said last week it was plainclothesmen or somebody used by the police establishment, and that getaway and the manipulation of Feinstein through this Richard Bloom. She met him last April of 78. He had been divorced and she was a widow, and he took her right away to the Himalayan mountains with some good friends, and he's been kind of the control and the Washington, D.C. links to that place called the City Hall in San Francisco. Bloom is the connecting agent of the politics of the Eastern establishment to the San Francisco political center. And if there was a center of Jonestown being a Defense Department experiment and a CIA experiment, and Moscone and Milk were killed because of the links of the police department and the San Francisco officials such as Tim Stone and Don Freitas and D.A. Hunter covering up all the links of the San Francisco politics to Jim Jones. The Washington connection is as Richard Blum. So now if she tells Gaines to resign, what she's really doing is making way for Charles Bates. By taking the resignation of Gaines at this time, there is this terrible specter of Bates taking over, and the question is she getting her orders from Richard Blum with his contacts to the D.C. establishment, to Mondale, he's very close to Mondale and the Trilateralists, international ties, so from Washington every week or monthly to Richard Blum, to Diane, now Charlie Bates, the Washington, D.C. FBI man, who's first trained in London, was in Chicago during these murders, responsible for the SLA murders and the kidnapping and the San Francisco racism and violence. You have a network here. I hope it isn't too complicated for you, but it's important to discuss it with you because I think a lot of this is going to shape connecting the East to the West and California to Washington to the whole Central Intelligence Network that's been working for a long, long time out here. A very fine man died this week, and he was in the process of writing two books. His name is Joseph Borkin. He was 67 years old, and he died in Chevy Chase, Washington, right outside of Washington in Maryland, from a heart attack. Joseph Borkin. He was writing two books, controversial books, on antitrust cases, and one book called The Lawyers of Watergate. I would just love to see the book that he was writing on Watergate. I hope it doesn't get relegated to the boneyard like the Martha Mitchell book she was writing, the George de Morenchild book that he was writing, the Gary Powers book that he was writing. Joseph Borkin, he was 67 years old. He worked in Washington, D.C. with the Senate Special Committee that investigated munitions industry and the Federal Communications Commission. He joined the Justice Department as early as 1938. He was their chief economist in the Antitrust Division. He's the author of the book, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. That was published last year in 1978. He linked I.G. Farben with Germany's war materials, the holding off of supplies of strategic war materials, how it was possible for Germany to survive during the war, and how they developed synthetic fuels, rubber, and so forth, and pharmaceutical products, and early work in plastics. The I.G. Farben, according to Borkin and others, purged all Jewish scientists from their work, and they used slave labor during the entire World War II. Of course, it was that Olvay chemical company that Pope John Paul II worked for, and that was a subsidiary of I.G. Farben at Auschwitz, called Auschwitz, Solvay Chemical Company. Mr. Borkin, according to the Washington Post, studied German political and economic history. He studied the Farben ties to the United States corporations, and then he studied the agreements by which I.G. Farben worked in Great Britain and in France. You see, those Farben chemicals could be very influential on persons such as Woodrow Wilson or Vito Perone to get rid of and many, many others. They were very much into chemicals for all. We can't forget the Jack Ruby cancer, the Martha Mitchell, the rare cancer. Goodness knows what these various companies could come up with and how they've used medicine to eliminate people that were in their way. The Farben companies, according to Mr. Borkin, of course, this has been written up from other sources also, was instrumental in working along with our allies, Britain and France, to bring about wartime shortages, aluminum, nickel, tungsten, carbide, magnesium, and so forth. We were cutting ourselves off in order to make sure that Germany won the war, because we really wanted them to win the war against Russia, but Russia held out at Stalingrad, and the tables were turned and moved west. Then we had to realign ourselves with Germany and Japan as soon as the war was over. Mr. Borkin wrote a book in 1962 called The Corrupt judge, which is about bribery and conflict of interest in the federal bench. But the important thing, one of the very important things, is, as I say, the two books that he was writing at the time of his death, one on the antitrust cases and the other, The Lawyers of Watergate, because the story of Watergate, I'm sure, would go back again to Charles Bates and the very persons that are working themselves up into the political mainstream across the country and are very influential in things that are happening today in terms of counterintelligence. Watergate was very little, actually, compared to what's happening today. So Joseph Borkin has died, and it'll be of interest to see if posthumously those books ever do get out, or be wonderful to know what was in them, but I'm sure we'll never know. Interesting timing that Joseph Borkin dies July the 6th, 1979, at the time that he's writing about these Lawyers of Watergate, and Charles Bates, the FBI man who had a major part in covering up the very first stories of Watergate in the Justice Department and the involvement of the people, announces just a week later, July 14th, 79, that he'd like to be chief of police in San Francisco. There was a story in the Associated Press out of Springfield, Missouri, that it was actually the San Francisco Chronicle out here on the drama page, lost in the back page, about page 42 or something, July the 12th, 1979. That was 8 days ago. As I say, Associated Press story, but in all the newspapers that I have so far around the country, I haven't seen this story. If any of you have the article, send me any copies you have on it. But this is terribly important. It's about a man in Springfield, Missouri, who was arrested. He was picked up and charged with murdering a lawyer by the name of Joseph Langworthy. And when he was arrested in Springfield, Missouri, he claimed that, I guess as part of his defense, he was going to tell about other murders he did. So he spilled out that he had killed a man in Detroit late July 1975, and that he was paid $30,000 to do that job, and that he believed it could be Jimmy Hoffa, the president, former president of the Teamsters Union. Hoffa disappeared on July 30th of that year, and he claims in July of 75 that he was paid $30,000 to kill a man in Detroit. But that isn't all he did. He claimed that he sabotaged an airplane crash in 1976 near Chillicothe, Missouri, that killed six persons. And on the plane was U.S. Representative Jerry Litton, a Democrat from Missouri. Now, I've talked on the tapes many times about the San Diego plane crash that was supposed to have Lieutenant Governor Merv Dimely from California running against Mike Curb, that fatal plane crash that he took the Sunday evening plane and wasn't killed on Monday, and the Obersham plane crash. There's been many, many crashes. This is the one where John Warner got the Senate seat, a staunch conservative in the Senate, over because of a small lightweight plane crash. There was one that Ted Kennedy missed just several weeks ago off of Cape Cod at Hyannisport. This man claims that he assisted to sabotage the killing of a U.S. Representative, Jerry Litton. There hasn't been a headline in any other paper or an article, and this is this shocking, because I've mentioned before also this man that worked for the CIA who told me about the 10 murders that he did for the CIA and that he stopped when he was supposed to kill Congressman Schroeder, the woman from Colorado. She's still alive, and he had blown that story and claimed that he was supposed to do that, and that's when he drew the line. But there hasn't been a thing about investigating the death of Representative Jerry Litton in Missouri. It'd be interesting if any of you have the time. I really don't have, because I'm working on a book, but I would just love it if some of you could go back to that time period before this last year and get the voting record of Representative Jerry Litton, or write to his family in Missouri. The congressional directories would have his address of the former representative, and ask the family if they ever investigated the sabotage and to get into those lawsuits, because if the conservatives can't get elected until we get a Congress identical to the Congress that elected Adolf Hitler in 1933. If they can't get elected, the opponents are being murdered along the way. I have said this for a long time, that we have these death squads, and the silence of this news from the other media is simply resounding. It's so obvious that this story should be investigated, and yet there's one press release, that's it, and silence. If you find any more about it, let me know, because I think it's important. I received an article from one of the listeners of our tape subscriptions called Tyrants Beware Copier and Cassette. Remember back at the time that the Shah of Iran was out and we were discussing the revolution of Mr. Khomeini and the way the tape cassettes were used to inform thousands of people in Iran about Savak and what the Shah of Iran was doing. And we talked about the importance of the revolution of the tape cassettes that were sent into Iran and were kept in bookcases and sold at the marketplace. Of course, anybody who was seen with them was tortured, I'm sure, by the Savak and removed. But people took a good chance to get this information out, and the chance worked. An article by Anthony Sampson that was sent to me, it's from London. He wrote The Sovereign State of the ITT and several other excellent books. This is from the Minneapolis Tribune, and it's about the influence of politics, asking, is modern technology beginning to turn against tyranny? And it's very much like the other tape I did on the tape cassette machine, but it talks about the Xerox copier, that the tape and the Xerox copier, the cassette and the copier, have been underestimated as a political power. And I'm sure that while I'm one of the first people in the country to start this type of newsletter, that it should catch on more and more. And I hope that some of you, I know a lot of you don't, but I hope that some of you are making cheaper copies of these cassettes that you can duplicate and get them off to your friends and families and members of Congress and so forth. And I know from the mail I'm getting that they're going to many, many places and being copied, large numbers of them, but not enough yet to make a political dent. We have to get more of these copies out, I think, to really make an influence on the milieu around the country. But this article goes into the fact that when a secretary runs off a paper for a system where there's an internal security, that one extra sheet can be used for blackmail, and the cassettes are revolutionary instruments in world politics. And the article concludes, perhaps the cassette and a copier will be as significant as the audiovisual age of Gutenberg's invention of book printing. Radio and TV are important, but the Xerox machine, just as I write my bibliography for you each week, I take it to Instant Copy, and they make copies. I have one copier at home, but they're not quite as good or clear for you. And these sheets can go all over the world and be put in envelopes and mail and information disseminated, which is a great way of saving time, and it's a great way of getting information out, book lists and sources of information. And I think more and more people are getting aware of the use of the cassette and the copying machine, and it is a political tool. If you use it right, if you use your voice and call up radio talk shows, and if you use this machinery right, it should be making itself felt in a short time in many, many ways before the cost of these things goes up and the lid is put on them that makes it not so easy to get the information out. You have to use it while it's available on the assumption that it could be cut off from you from the same time if it's too good a thing. Just as in Argentine, you can't hear the song, Don't Cry for Me, Argentine. There can be orders of no tape cassettes or no cassette machines. That happened when the people went down to Jonestown. They took $5,000 and their tape recorders and cassette machines for music or messages or to send letters home. And the first thing Jim Jones did when they got into Georgetown in Guyana was to take away the tape cassette. It couldn't be used to send messages home. The messages home had to be dictated and screened, and the messages that came back were controlled. And he knew the power of the tape cassette to get a message home like, hey, I'm starving, send for me, or call Congress, or get the American Embassy here. That wasn't allowed. The tape cassette is a political instrument. It's a very important instrument. like the typewriter and the printing press, and you should respect it and use it and duplicate these tapes and send them to public officials. And I couldn't guarantee we'd get any action, but it'd be interesting to know if they ever really were flooded with information, and the country could be flooded with information made available through these printed sheets reaching more people and the tapes reaching more people. I've been getting mail asking about any follow-up of Bob Trevor on KGO and Jogwell Bank and any more about Alternative 3. There isn't a word. Nobody from Great Britain in the establishment where Sir William Ballantyne was alleged to work will come forward and get on the air and deny that they know who he is, and yet they won't get on the air or have any articles or interviews saying that Alternative 3 is hogwash and that it's pure fiction. I have many, many articles every week on the bad air, the overpopulation, the allegations that are in Alternative 3 are in the news every week. A listener from New Jersey sent me an article, "New Generation of Astronauts is Ready." This is from Gloucester County Times, Sunday, July the 8th, 1979. And it's from the Space Center in Houston, Texas, and it's about the challenge of the new piloting the new spaceship, and that new astronauts are ready to go up and operate the way, see how humans operate beyond their home planet. This article says the shuttle, space shuttle, is the size of a DC-9 jetliner. It will carry up to 7 persons and 65,000 pounds of cargo. After its mission, it will land on a runway of its initial launching bases, and Cape Canaveral, Florida, will be refurbished, and it will go back again in 2 weeks, and every shuttle will make at least 100 trips. By 1983, a second shuttle base will be at Vandenberg Air Force in California, mainly for military missions conducted by the Defense Department. At first, the shuttle will do things now assigned to expendable rockets, put satellites in orbit for communications, weather forecasting, Earth resources survey, scientific research, and military reconnaissance. And then they'll fix these satellites in space and send back information. NASA has sold out the first 32 operational flights through the first half of 1983. You know, I talked about that on the tape about China making their reservations. And the users will be from the Defense Department, the ITT, the International Telephone Communications Satellite Consortium, the European Space Agency, private industry, and foreign countries. More than 100 major oil, gas, and engineering firms, for example, formed a committee to work with NASA to develop space sensors to search for the Earth's natural resources. Pharmaceutical and high technological firms hope to take advantage of weightless orbiting to simplify the manufacture of their items, of exotic enzymes and pure vaccines and single crystal semiconductors. Space factories and space colonies to support them could evolve from this research and open up the next industrial revolution. A man from Houston, Texas, says the shuttle will lead to the solution of the Earth's growing energy shortage. They will assemble a huge structure that could capture the sun's rays and beam them to the Earth for conversion to energy. Whatever we have, whether it is a permanent station, a moon base, a solar power satellite, it's the shuttle that will get us back and forth. The idea of finding how man can live and what adaptations he will have to make in terms of long-term space colony or moon colony fascinate me, one person said in the article. The machinery of space is great, but the human aspect interests me more. And of course, this gets back to what I said all along for many, many years, that a handful of corporations have used American tax dollars to build space station satellites so that they can see where the agriculture is, where the famines are, where the water is, where the minerals, the many, many minerals are, the reserves, or even gold in the ocean. And the taxpayers make the stations, but we don't get a percentage of what they see there. They can spot the land, kick people off their land, grab the land, overthrow countries, and continue this huge, imperialistic, monopolistic grab by having the advantage of the machinery up there to tell them what is going down in the earth, so that everything we have is subject to their acquiring it, to overtaxing us, to making us lose our property, If they want specific things that are under our land, and the globe is simply a place to be photographed and x-rayed so that they can go in and take the grabs just as Adolf Hitler killed the bodies and pulled the gold out of the teeth. This is the rate of planet Earth paid for by the taxpayers to build the cameras and the satellites so that they can come down and take all the minerals and all the resources necessary for their profits and make these huge microwave weapons and tell us it's for a great advancement. It's the Western movement that killed off the Indians and the animal, the wildlife. It's similar to that. This is the rape of planet Earth by NASA and the space agencies with no noticeable benefit that will come to hardly a single person while they fly up there and photograph and take a view of us, an x-ray view of what's here on the Earth for their own financial purposes, and we pay for the machinery. Our time is up now. I'll be with you next week. You take care and have a good week. This is Mae Brussels in Carmel, California.